To paraphrase Elaine from the Jerry Seinfeld show, integrity, what is it good for? As it turns out, it's good for quite a bit, which I will get to in a moment. But first, I want to relate a bit of my background because it is important to how I view integrity and what it means to have it. I was raised a Southern Baptist, but I left as a teenager because my interest in science led me to reject the Bible literalism of that church. I'm a biologist, and I view the world through that lens. I have a bachelor's and master's degree from the University of Florida and a doctorate from Penn State. I'm retired now, but I had a nearly 30-year career as a wildlife biologist for the Natural Resources Conservation Service, a division of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. In that career, I did a variety of things, including assisting landowners improve wildlife habitat, writing environmental impact statements for flood control projects, teaching wetland restoration to our field people, and writing a method for evaluating the wetland functions and values, which is still in use today. But my most rewarding work was doing ecosystem restoration, primarily the restoration of salt marshes and xeric woodlands in New Hampshire and elsewhere. After I retired, I wrote a book about healing the biosphere, which is our global ecosystem, that thin layer of the Earth's crust and atmosphere in which all known life exists and on which it depends. In that book, I emphasize that healing the biosphere is both a scientific and moral issue. Throughout my career in retirement, I have done a lot of thinking about morality and ethics from the perspective of a biologist. But first things first, a good scientist begins with the definition of terms. So I Googled the various definitions of integrity, and they mostly read something along the lines of adherence to a code of moral and ethical values. A second definition was as a term applied to something that was intact or complete. Now that seems clear. We all know what adherence is, and I think that it is safe to say that we all know what moral and ethical values are. So maybe I should just end the sermon here and tell you to go forth and practice your moral values. But I won't do that, because I don't think it is that simple. As a scientist, I tend to ask myself a lot of questions, and in doing so, I had the epiphany that there's a real problem with the dictionary definition of the word integrity. Specifically, none of the definitions explain what constitutes moral and ethical values. So I dug a little bit deeper and Googled the dictionary definition of the word morals and ethics. Ethics is typically defined as a set of external rules to live by, and morals as our internal definition of what is good. Now, I don't find these definitions very helpful because they merely kick the can down the street. That is the problem with dictionary definitions. They send you down a rabbit hole, chasing the definition of the words used to define the word you looked up in the first place. So the bulk of my message is about what constitutes a valid set of moral and ethical values that we should adhere to. Now, I believe that if we are honest, each of us believes that we adhere to a set of moral and ethical values that we think is pretty darn good, if not the best. I would even go so far as to say that virtually everyone in the world thinks that they are living by a terrific set of moral and ethical values. But where do we get our set of moral and ethical values, and how do we determine if they are good? I would venture to say that most people get them directly or indirectly through religion. I mean, even atheists are influenced by the Ten Commandments because they are woven into our culture and law. But here's the thing. I maintain that religions, by and large, have failed to incorporate into their theology the one thing I believe is necessary to a set of moral and ethical values. And that is a belief that healing and maintaining the biosphere is both a scientific necessity and a moral imperative. If we are to have a future, the right to a healthy biosphere must be recognized as the fundamental right upon which all other rights rest, including life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Unfortunately, most of the world's major religions are not only silent on this issue, but may promulgate beliefs that I believe encourage the degradation of the biosphere. Religions, for the most part, have failed to keep up with the advances in our scientific understanding of how the world actually operates. This is understandable because most of the sacred texts of the world's religions come from a time when little scientific knowledge was available, and the world was seen through the veil of myth and superstition. Because these myths had little basis in facts, there is even now much controversy about what is moral and ethical value, to the point that religious wars have caused much suffering and death, as well as degradation of the biosphere. I will give you a few examples, with a disclaimer that they are my interpretation of what a few religions say about morals and ethics as it relates to our treatment of the biosphere. The sacred text of the Abrahamic religions rest much of their morals and ethics on the belief that God has given us the earth to dominate and subdue. I would refer you to the two creation stories in Genesis. The result is a widespread view that the world is merely an antechamber for an afterlife. In addition, the widespread injunction against birth control and abortion does nothing to address the world's overpopulation. Hinduism is a complex religion that is difficult to summarize, but in at least one story, God periodically recreates the world. This seems to me to mean that the present world is relatively unimportant. Buddhism, as I understand it, was not meant as a religion, but as a philosophical practice. But in practice, it has largely become a religion whose goal is to help the individual escape from the endless cycle of birth and rebirth, a belief that is not particularly helpful in attaining a healthy biosphere. Chinese communism, which also purports to be a political system and not a religion, is in fact an amalgam of Confucianism, Buddhism, and Marxism that places human needs above all else and has resulted in a stunning reduction in biodiversity in that country. I have been there and seen that with my own eyes. I do not give us a free pass either. Although one of our seven principles is a respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part, there is no specific mention of the biosphere, nor any moral imperative to heal it of the damage we have done it. My point is that religion, as it is often practiced, does not reflect what we now know about the reality of the universe, a deficiency that leads us to do great harm to each other and to the biosphere. This was driven home to me by a coworker whose job title was resource conservationist. He considered himself a good Christian, but he told me in all seriousness that he wanted to use up the world's resources because it would hasten the second coming of Christ. Now, I do not want to imply that science can give us moral and ethical values. It cannot. As someone said, science gives us means, but no ends. The science of ecology can tell us that a wetland or forest exists and the functions they perform, but cannot tell us that they ought to exist. That requires human judgment. In essence, science can tell us what life is, but not how to live it. But if we are to decide how to live our lives, we ought to understand what science says about life and how it operates. To a biologist, life has two distinct aspects. First, life is an objective process, an emergent property of matter and energy governed by the laws of physics, chemistry, and biology. But second, life is a subjective experience. It is our view of the world looking out through our senses. It is within life as a subjective experience that art, music, and poetry live. It is where we do what we are doing now, practicing our religion. But beyyond this experience of that we call being human, there is the objective process of life which goes on whether we know or care about it. The process of life I'm talking about is that of biological evolution, which is the rule of life that all life, including our own, must obey. It is the process that created life and continues to govern it. For the non-scientist, evolution can be understood as a game. The object of the game is survival and reproduction. The biosphere is the arena in which the game is played. There are no spectators. We and all other species are the players. The equipment for the game is the evolutionary adaptations of each player. This equipment is supplied by our genes, which are modified periodically by random mutations. Most mutations are lethal, but occasionally a mutation improves a player's chance of survival and is passed down to future generations. There is only one rule. and that is those best suited to their habitat survive. The referee is natural selection. Winning is temporary because the arena is always changing and old adaptations no longer fit new conditions. Losing is extinction by not having evolved the right adaptations at the right time. There are no timeouts, and the game continues as long as there are players. Humans, for all their protestations and sense of self-importance, are simply another animal species as far as evolution is concerned. We have evolved our adaptations just like a tiger or a jellyfish, our primary adaptations being our upright posture, sentience, sapience, and manual dexterity. We use these adaptations to play the evolution game just like a tiger uses its claws or a jellyfish uses its tentacles to meet our immediate needs for food, shelter, and the opportunity to reproduce. So far, we have been successful. But here's the problem. Our adaptations are orders of magnitude more powerful in the evolution game than any other species. A team of extraterrestrial ecologists from a highly advanced civilization would quickly see us for what we are. A newly sapient species, intelligent enough to understand that we are rapidly destroying the health of the biosphere, but not yet intelligent enough to control our instincts to do so. They would classify us as a super keystone species, a keystone species being one that significantly alters its habitat, thereby impacting that of many other species. For example, the beaver, whose impoundments provide habitat for many species, but which eliminate the habitat of others. We are a super keystone species because of the magnitude of our impacts. We don't simply use the habitats provided by the biosphere. We are in the process of reshaping it to suit our needs. Our exploitation of the biosphere to meet our needs greatly exceeds its carrying capacity. In doing so, we are making it unlivable for our species and likely for all other species. Now, the rub is that this is neither good nor bad. It is simply how evolution works. The plan of evolution is that there is no plan, only process. What survives, survives. Whether it is us or cockroaches, evolution is impartial. I believe that the problem is that we are not yet an intelligent species. Rather, we are a species with intelligence. In fact, it is an open question whether intelligence is a successful evolutionary adaptation. It is only in the last 10,000 years or so that we have really gotten rolling with what our intelligence can do. The good news is that we are here, largely because of the technology our intelligence has given us. The bad news is that we have not used our adaptations to plan for our long-term survival as a species. We have not been guided by what we know about the world, but by what evolution has programmed us to feel about it. I believe that we have created deities to avoid the existential angst of knowing that we live in an indifferent universe. We have failed to recognize that our creator is not some metaphysical deity living on a cloud who has given us leave to dominate and subdue the world, as many sacred texts would have us believe. Rather, our creator is the biosphere. We are literally the children of the biosphere, and at the same time, we are an integral part of it. Although the biosphere is very robust, having supported life for more than 3 billion years through many catastrophic events, the cumulative impacts of human activities over the last several millennia are rapidly destroying its health. Our foolishness is leading to a world more suited to rodents, roaches, and other species we consider vermin than ourselves. This brings us back to what I began with, and that is a definition of integrity which led to the question of what the moral and ethical values are we are supposed to adhere to. By now, you may have guessed that my concept of morals and ethics requires an understanding of life as it exists as an objective process. It may not be the life we would wish for, but it is likely the only one we get. Personally, I would prefer a world guided and looked over by a beneficent deity, a world in which I can look forward to an eternal life where all are at peace. But as a scientist, I understand that such a world is most likely wishful thinking. Instead, I recognize that our moral and ethical values must include, indeed must be centered around, the concept of a healthy biosphere. I see integrity as the glue that holds together a purposeful society. And I would maintain that such a purpose must be informed by the scientific understanding of the biosphere, as well as reverence towards it as our creator. And from such an understanding would come a deep belief that a healthy biosphere is a human right and humanity's responsibility. Finally, I would say that to have integrity is to adhere to those values which include a moral imperative to heal and maintain the integrity of the biosphere. Amen, and thank you for the privilege of giving this sermon.